Good morning, and may it please the court. Today I'd like to discuss with the court the verdict director issue, which is appellant's point one. And I'd like to begin by kind of really thinking about the role instructions play in a criminal case, and in particular a capital case. This was simply a, not simply, but it was a penalty phase retrial. The only issue was sentencing. There's only one instruction that provides a comprehensive roadmap in a capital sentencing proceeding, and that instruction is the what we call the sentencing verdict director, MAI 313.48A. In this case, it's undergone a number of revisions. Here it was given as instruction 10. Now, under MAI, the sentencing verdict director should direct jurors through the entire unfamiliar process of applying complex capital law to a full set of facts that they hear over a course of a number of days. The court's instructions are the law. The MAI roadmap covers every step of the capital sentencing proceeding through the revisions this court has enacted or adopted, I guess. It now does cover all the steps. It takes the jury through section 565.030.4, 1, 2, and 3, or because those have been revised, the particular steps that are applicable. For the jury, it's not only a checklist of what they need to consider in reaching a verdict, but it's a guide to the sentencing steps. For this court and for other courts, it's an attempt, this verdict director, the sentencing capital verdict director, is an attempt to ensure that the capital sentencing process that every jury goes through complies with the Eighth Amendment requirements of reliability, and to make sure that jurors specifically consider mitigation. Unfortunately, here, even though defense counsel twice spoke to the court about the verdict director in this case, the sentencing verdict director, and said, you know, Judge, I think we're missing something. I think this verdict director has omitted the mitigation. I think it should be here. And keep in mind, this was not an instruction that the defense submits. It's a state submission. The court simply said, well, make your record. I'm not changing any of my instructions. And that was it. I have my little outline. I had not planned to depart at this point. But I do want to, at this point, because I think it's really important to consider why this court requires attorneys to make timely objections. And this is a classic example. Had the court really looked at the instructions and said, well, let's dig out the MAI, let's look, just like that, the court would have known the instruction that it had was wrong. It was an old instruction. And it had been revised to contain all the law, not just some of the section 565.030.4 steps, but all the applicable law.
Did defense counsel point the court to the MAI CR and the new version, or did they not have that before the court at the time?
I don't think defense counsel actually had those instructions. There's some, if you look at the record, and I don't have it right in front of me, my recollection is defense counsel says, you know, I'm not really sure about this, but this is the first record she's making. I think that there's a problem with this. I think it's supposed to include the mitigation step here. And then she gets back on and says, I really want to make sure the record is clear on this. I want to make sure you understand that here's how it should be. And I think if she had in her hand the MAI, she would have given it to the court. But my understanding is the courts have those right there, and certainly the prosecutor should have had that.
Is there a requirement on defense counsel not just to say there's something wrong with this, but is defense counsel required to offer the correct instruction to the court?
Excuse me. I don't believe so, Your Honor. I've never seen that. I think it's helpful, certainly, if defense counsel can pull out the MAI and say, look, this is what the MAI is. But it's not the defense instruction, although, as a matter of fact, I think in this case, I think counsel may have done that because they offered a number. Yeah, I think it's instruction E. Yeah, if you, it's in appellant's appendix, and that's at A39. Instruction E does contain the mitigating language, and that was offered to the court. So the court had that. I think there were some other changes, but it certainly would have at least had the correct language when she was talking about mitigation.
Can you address further the prejudice issue, and in particular that, if I understand the sequence correctly, the instruction was modified to include the mitigation language in that final instruction. Some mitigation language is used in other instructions already, but this is sort of a summary instruction and doesn't refer to that. Prior cases, though, have been submitted under the same instruction that was used in this case and not found prejudice or error. If an instruction is not followed that should be followed, it's error, it's prejudicial effect to be judicially determined. Why was it particularly prejudicial here, or are you saying really if it had been raised it would have been prejudicial in all those prior cases where the earlier instruction was given?
I think there are several reasons. First of all, as we all know, this instruction has undergone numerous revisions, and this court's had a long time to think about it. And at some point decided it was better to have the mitigation language in there. So it's not just, as the state said, first of all, it's not just a housekeeping matter. It really incorporates now all the law. So those earlier cases were decided under a very different MAI. That's a big difference, I think. Second, as this court said in Deck, every case has to be decided on its own facts. And when you look at the facts of this case, this particular case is unlike those earlier cases, and there were three the state cited. If my memory is correct, it was State v. Cole, State v. Tysius, and State v. Story. And if you look at the facts in those cases, and I'll just briefly go into them, and then I'll talk about the facts in this case, and I'll try to do this as succinctly as I can. In Tysius, if you remember, it was a planned attempt to spring the defendant's comrade from jail. And the defendant was going to go into the jail armed and point the gun at the sheriff and get him to release his friend. Instead, the defendant walked in and fired and killed two police officers at the jail. That's Mr. Tysius. He had no prior contact with either of those officers. You know, there was nothing in their history that created any mitigation to this whatsoever of that crime. Mr. Cole was a case where the defendant had a turbulent relationship with his wife, but she was not the victim. The defendant broke into his wife's house, stormed in there because she was with another man. He was going after his wife. Instead, he shot her boyfriend or her friend who was at the house. Again, no prior relationship between the defendant and the victim who was killed. Just shot him. The third case, Story, same thing. Mr. Story went into his neighbor's apartment, and I think there was some, I'm trying to remember what the aggravators were. I think they're, you know, I'm just blanking on them, but the main thing is he had no history with this victim, just shot. There was nothing to mitigate it. In contrast, what you have here and what was brought out at trial was that Terrence had a long and turbulent relationship with the victim in this case. And I may use the term victims because there were actually two, although we're only talking about the one that was reversed for a new penalty phase. And in particular, as to this victim, this was the mother of his girlfriend. She and Terrence had an ongoing dispute. And it centered around the child that Terrence and Abby, that's the daughter of the victims, had a child together. Terrence, who was determined to be part of this child's life because his own father had abandoned him, his own natural father, was concerned about the welfare of the child. there were instances that people testified to, not just Terrence, but other people testified to, about ongoing turbulence between the mother, Debbie. One of the things that really concerned Terrence was that Debbie would be holding the baby with one hand and smoking a cigarette with the other hand, and Terrence kept saying, you really shouldn't be smoking around the child, and at one point tried to grab the child from Debbie. He ended up, she got a restraining order against him for that. His concern was for the child. Abby's parents, Debbie and Stephen, were concerned because Terrence was black. The Rainwaters were white. They didn't want their daughter dating a black person. They didn't want Abby dating Terrence because he was older. This was just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. There came a point when they got a restraining order. In fact, they had more than one restraining order, but then they never enforced them. It was sort of just a real turbulent relationship, on and on and on. And the whole time, and you know, Abby's friends and Abby herself testified, Terrence really wanted to be part of the child's life. And what was going on, at least in Terrence's mind, was that Abby's parents were keeping him from the child. The final straw was that he had been supposed to babysit for the baby, and instead of bringing the baby to Terrence's house, the Rainwaters got a restraining order against him, and he wasn't allowed to have the baby. And that, you know, he just kind of went off after that. The other kind of mitigation, which doesn't so much concern the offense, but you can see this is a really different kind of offense. It's a really emotionally turbulent, emotional-laden relationship. It wasn't the kind of cold, I'm going to go over there and shoot him kind of thing. Although he did go over and shoot him, but there was this whole history behind it. The other kind of mitigation that really makes a difference in this case is that Terrence, this was so out of character for Terrence. People who had known him, parents of his friends, came in and said, I would never have expected this. I had known him as a child. I knew him growing up. I was shocked. I was surprised. High school friends, high school teachers, high school coaches came in and said, I would never have expected this. This was so out of character for him. Terrence, until he met Abby, and I think that was a point where things started to become too much for him, and his life became very turbulent, you know, when he became mixed up with Abby. He had no history. This was a good kid. He basically played basketball. He was a point guard. If you know about basketball, it's a position of responsibility. Coaches trusted him. He was an assistant to a coach. He was always on time. He did his job. He never complained. He worked hard. People couldn't say enough good things about this guy. The third reason that we have prejudice here, and we know this from non-capital cases, and if there are other questions about the mitigation, I'll be happy to talk about it, but I don't want to spend all my time on that. You can read the record in the briefs. There's plenty of it. We know from non-capital cases that where there is a defense, and there, even where there's a defense instruction, there should be a reference in the verdict director. And there's a Southern District case, McClure, and there are other cases as well that are, you know, all a little bit different. But basically they say, if you omit something that's required by the MAI and it supports the defense, it's prejudicial error. I want to read to you, and McClure is an interesting case, and I cite that in the brief. It's a Southern District case, I think, because the only thing left out of the verdict director was a reference, you know, just the reference to the defense instruction. There's another case, State v. Nunn, and this is interesting because they actually talk about why it's prejudicial. And here's what they say. The defendant had no defense on the facts. His only salvation was in mitigation from assault in the first degree with its strict penalties. This was a non-capital, you know, this was the guilt phase. Defendant was entitled to have the issue of mitigation called to the attention of the jury twice. once negatively in the state's main verdict director and again in a separate and direct instruction. It would have benefited the defendant by lending additional dignity and importance to the issue of mitigation. By depriving defendant of that benefit, he was prejudiced. In a non-capital case where there's an omission and they reverse, I don't see how you can get more prejudicial than in a capital case where life is at stake. I mean, that's the essence of the Eighth Amendment. You have to ensure reliability, and I think we failed to do that here, and I think that's prejudicial. It's not, and that kind of takes us to the burden of proof, because this error is preserved. It's fully preserved. This means that it's up to the state to show beyond a reasonable doubt that there was no prejudice. Now, the court decides the prejudicial effect, but the state's got to show that to you. And I'm talking about prejudice because I want you to understand the full context of the facts in deciding this case. I don't see how they can show there's no prejudice. I do believe that excluding mitigation from the verdict director minimized its importance, just as in Nunn and in all those other non-capital cases. Instructions are the law that the trial court gives to the jury. And there's an instruction, instruction 3 in this case, that tells the jury that, the law is in these instructions. So if you leave out from the verdict director that wraps it all up, this roadmap, if you leave out mitigation, how is the jury going to take that? Well, prejudice is, the way we define prejudice when there's ambiguity. And I think what happens if you have one instruction, in this case it was instruction 8, I think, that was the mitigating, the weighing step. And then all of a sudden in the verdict director, there is not a word about mitigation. At best, you have ambiguity. You have confusion. How does the jury resolve that? Well, we don't know. We don't know how they resolve that. One thing they could decide is, well, we were supposed to look at mitigation there, but we're done with that. Here, when we're returning a verdict, we've already looked at mitigation. We're done with that. We don't do it anymore. I don't think that's right. Instruction 10, the verdict director wrapped it all up. The jury could well believe that mitigation was no longer applicable. I will say that one thing the verdict director does not do, and this is what the court in DEC 1, which was the direct appeal in DEC, found that the instruction, and that was a Mills error, it was a slightly different error. Here there was language omitted from 313.44. The court found that another instruction told the jury they were never required to impose a sentence of death, and, when the jury read all these instructions together, that took care of it. DEC, of course, DEC 1 was plain error. It ultimately, this court reversed it under the ineffective assistance of counsel standard. We're dealing here with direct appeal plain error. It's not our job to show prejudice. It's up to the state to prove lack of prejudice. One thing this verdict director does not do, it doesn't even reference, and even though I know this verdict director's been tweaked, the MAI, it doesn't reference that other instruction that says you're never required to impose a sentence of death. So what the jury got, because of the imperfect verdict director here, is they got an instruction at the end taking them down the road to death. It was tilted to death. There was no mention of mitigation. And for that reason, I believe it was prejudicial. If there are no other questions about this, I can go on talking. But I will stop now. And I would only like to address briefly one other point. And we did raise a point concerning the veneer, the lack of fair cross-section of the community in the veneer. And the state challenged our point, saying it wasn't preserved. So I looked at the state's cases in preparation for this argument, and they rely on a case called Simkowski, Stafy Simkowski. And Simkowski and says, you have to make your objection to the veneer before trial. Well, they did do that. These people did object. The defense counsel did object before trial. And then I looked at other cases, and there's some question, and it's somewhat unsettled about what is before trial? Does that mean before the, you know, before voir dire starts? Does that mean before you start questioning the jury? Is that before you start presenting evidence? My understanding of the cases is that if you object before the jury is called into the courtroom and seated, that's timely, and that is what we had here. There was an objection before the jury was seated. So because I did not specifically in the reply brief say, no, you're wrong, this is preserved, I'm saying it now.
So you don't think that since what they're objecting to was the whole veneer, the whole process of calling people to the court, to calling people to be questioned, that they had to raise it at an earlier point or present broader statistical evidence and so forth?
I don't think they had to. I think raising it before that jury is called into court and seated is timely. You know, certainly I'm not saying it would have been wrong to raise it earlier. They could have raised it earlier, but they challenged both the petty jury at that point and the veneer, and they may have just done it all at once. But I think it was sufficient to preserve it.
And what did they present in their challenge?
They made an argument, basically.
Did they have evidence about veneers in general, or was it more, if I recall, it was a number of instances of specific cases being tried?
Well, that was in my brief. Okay. Those were cases I came across in researching this point. The argument basically was just a legal challenge to the veneer, and they pointed out that they presented the statistics. They didn't go into the percentages, which mm-hmm. I did. They said the veneer had, and I don't remember, just less than a handful, maybe
two or three,
you know, out of maybe 114 jurors, 100 were white and 4 were black or something, or less than that. Because the percentage of the veneer, as I figured it, was something like 1.9. That was the percentage of black jurors in the veneer. But the percentage, or 2%, I don't remember exactly.
Is that all they have to do to shift the burden? Is all they have to do to shift the burden is to say this veneer had 2% and the number of people, African-Americans, living in the county is 5.4%. And that would that be enough to shift the burden to the state to show that there is a they use utility receipts or whatever to get their jurors? Does that shift the burden at that point?
I think at that point the judge should have asked for, you know, should have asked for inquiry, you know, asked for evidence on it. Should have heard evidence on it. You know, that they made the objection and he should have heard evidence. This court could remand for evidence on it. The one thing that I did learn or figured out, I guess, when I was writing the brief was that based on the percentage of black people in this county, the percentage of black jurors was less than 50% of what the percentage of the population of the county. I'm having trouble saying that correctly.
Does the county include Haytay Heights? Does Cape Girardeau include Haytay Heights?
You know, I don't know that.
No.
I don't think so. I think that's down in the Boot Heel.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Cape Girardeau is further up. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. But the overall black population of Cape Girardeau County, I think, is 5.9. That's the percentage. The percentage of black people in Cape Girardeau County, the percentage of black people on the jury was less than half of that. You're dealing with small numbers, and that makes it trickier. Thank you.
So why would they have the verdict director if it didn't mean anything?
I think the point of the verdict director in this case is that it tells them how to fill out the forms. If you read through all of the 4 major instructions in a death penalty case, which were in this case 6, 7, 8, they instruct the jury to find a statutory aggravator beyond a reasonable doubt. The second one instructs them in how to consider non-statutory aggravators. The third, number 8, instructs them in how to consider mitigating evidence. the then after that they have the life option and then the verdict director. And that's what makes this case different from the non-death penalty cases that are cited by appellant to support the inference that the verdict director has to include everything about the defense. Here, there's a full section of instructions to explain how to reach the verdict. And then there is this instruction, the verdict.
Don't you think in a death case there'd be more attention to detail than non-death cases? I mean, it is pretty final.
Which is why we have this extra instruction instead of just one verdict director. In most felony cases, what you have is you have one verdict director. There isn't another director. It says, you shall, if you find X, Y, and Z, you shall find the defendant guilty. And then they have, and then you do, or in sentencing, they have just one thing, this is the range of punishment, and you find that. Here, first you have the thing explaining how they get to it, and then you have this instruction explaining how to fill out the forms. And the form to impose a death penalty is more complicated than the form to impose life, because in the verdict form for imposing a death penalty, they have to sign it and they have to write in the statutory aggravators that they found beyond a reasonable doubt, whereas in the life form, they only have to sign it. And the verdict director that was given in this case has included a paragraph that said, if you find that he should be punished for life imprisonment, then your foreman should sign the verdict director, the form so indicating, whatever the exact language was. So what happens here, the verdict director in a death penalty case is substantively different from the verdict director in a non-death penalty case, because what it does is it instructs you how to fill out forms, whereas the previous instructions number 6, 7, and 8 instructed the jury into how to reach their decision. And there, the jury was instructed in mitigation, and it said you should consider all the circumstances in mitigation, and if you conclude that they outweigh the circumstances in aggravation of punishment, you should assess the punishment at life.
Do you agree that the current verdict director at the time, do you agree that the current verdict director at the time would have required this mitigation language?
I think
in your brief you say that you use the word probably should.
But it's a difficult question, and if I had been the judge, I would have included this language.
How can it be difficult? Either it was or wasn't required by MAI.
I think because of the fact that when the 313.44 and that series was updated in 2004, the corresponding instructions where they're modified in 313.00 were not updated to reflect that update.
But there was an update. You're saying the samples didn't have it, but the instruction required it.
The instruction required it, but the samples didn't have it in the appendix. And the difference there is what happens is when the defense counsel in this case objected, he looked at that and thought he was using the right one.
I understand how it happened, but it's either right or it's wrong. And then you're talking, how that it was not intentional, you're saying, because people were looking at the wrong model. But if it was required, we don't also say that you don't have to follow these requirements if sample instructions don't include them. That's maybe not your strongest argument, maybe.
I agree. And my the point in the brief was not to say explicitly that, hey, this was the right instruction. What I'm saying is this wasn't, and I'm not saying, hey, this is why it happened. What the state is arguing there is that this was not the state trying to take advantage. This was not the judge trying to trample on defendants' rights. This was an error that happened because of an unclear
the motive example. Doesn't really matter. The motive doesn't really matter whether it's the judge or what the instructions are that are given to the jury.
That's correct. And that's why, again, the majority of the brief state's brief addresses the prejudice issue. And here, there was no prejudice because the it was the mitigation was.
Do you agree with opposing counsel that you have the burden to prove that there was no prejudice?
When the instruction was zero, that's correct, yes. But there is clearly no prejudice in this case for several reasons. First of all, let's go to DEC. In DEC is in a posit in this case for two reasons. First, the mitigation paragraph that was omitted in DEC was the paragraph that was in what was in this case instruction number 8. It was 313.44. That is where the jury is doing their operative consideration. It didn't have the paragraph that says consider any mitigating evidence. It didn't have the balancing step. Then when you get to the verdict director, at that point they've mostly already made their decision. They're just figuring out how to fill out the forms. Secondly, in DEC, the jury, there was no mention, this court specifically pointed out that it was prejudicial because there was no mention of mitigating circumstances in voir dire, and there was no, and the jury twice asked for clarification on the definition of mitigation. And in this case, the jury wasn't confused about mitigation. And while in the reply brief, appellant notes that, well, this just means that probably they didn't consider mitigation. If you look at the jury instructions, the jury wrote on them, and they put stars next to things and underlined things. And in each of these instructions, they put a star next to the, if you find that the defendant should be punished for life imprisonment, then, you know, your foreman should sign that.
Find out, but your burden is incredibly beyond, it's not just beyond a reasonable doubt. Beyond a reasonable doubt, you have to prove the negative, that there was no prejudice.
And that's what I'm saying. There was no prejudice here because the jury considered the mitigating evidence. In three different instructions, they starred sections pertaining to mitigation. In the verdict director, they starred the life instruction. In instruction number 9, where it says you never have to impose death, the life option instruction, they starred that instruction. And then in instruction number 8, they starred the section where it said you should consider any evidence in mitigation.
So the language that was missing in instruction number 10, was that covered in any other instructions?
It was covered in instruction number 8, and that was the instruction number 8. That exact language appears in the bottom of that.
That's the weighing instruction?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, in instruction number 8, they underlined twice the fact that it was not necessary for all the jurors upon particular facts and circumstances in mitigation and punishment.
That's correct.
So and you're saying the fact that somebody, I don't know how we would know who, the fact that somebody went to the effort to underline that instruction is some demonstration that they read it and considered it?
Yes, and I think it's definitely a reasonable inference that the jury is the one who wrote those because they circled the statutory aggravators that they found in instruction number 6 or 7, I believe it is.
When was this change made, and have we ever approved this instruction that was in fact given in this case without the paragraph?
This instruction that was given without the paragraph was approved before the change. The change was made in 2004, and I could not find a case that addressed this specific issue after that, although there are cases that find that as far as other instructions, the burden of proof is properly stated in the instructions. The other thing that it bears noting as far as finding prejudice is that when a pattern instruction is changed, that does not mean that the previous pattern was error. The case that says that specifically is State v. Richardson. It's a late 90s case. And what happened here, there was no change in law that prompted the addition of this paragraph. In other cases, when there is a change of law, you'll look at the notes on use and they'll say, oh, because of such and such a case or because of such and such a law, we've modified this instruction. Here, it was just part of the continuing process to improve the pattern instructions. And so there was the original instruction, as it was given pre-2004, was not error. It properly instructed the jury in the law.
Can you address that? Because it does refer to the other required findings and to aggravation and so forth, but does not refer at all to mitigation. Why was that not misleading? Why does that adequately set out the law?
Well, because when it refers to those, the aggravating factors, that's because the jury has to write those onto the verdict form when you're finding a death sentence. But when they only find a life sentence, all they have to do is sign the verdict form. So all that instruction includes is a paragraph that says, if you assess the punishment at life, you have to sign the verdict form. And so it wasn't necessary to repeat that information. And this new paragraph, just in an abundance of caution, repeats that the weighing step information to kind of balance it. But the instruction as it was adequately instructed them in the law because of that difference in the verdict forms, not because of any more weight that they were giving to a specific.
Do you, on another topic of the veneer panel,
yes.
Do you still assert the your opposing counsel said they did preserve the error? On looking at the record, do you say they didn't preserve the error or they did?
Unless
the factual.
It is a factual question, and I had not thought about that particularly in preparing for the argument. Because it wasn't addressed in the reply brief, I stand by my argument in the brief. And I think the thing is, what we have here is we have two different trials. They objected to the veneer on this issue, on the fair cross-section claim, before the original trial. The fair cross-section claim, then it was affirmed on direct, and then this court reversed on a jury selection issue based on the post-conviction case. And then when it went back, they did not re-raise that fair cross-section claim until after the jury had been selected. Before the jury was seated in the second trial, the only objections they reiterated did not include this fair cross-section claim. And so, yes, technically, in that first trial, they raised this issue. It was before the panel was seated. But given the procedural posture of this case, it didn't sufficiently bring it to the judge's attention to preserve the issue. And but in any event, there's no need for reversal because the information presented on this claim was not sufficient to show a prima facie case. A prima facie case, as far as a cross-section claim, they have to not only show that this particular panel was unrepresented or that a random selection of panels was unrepresented. They have to show a statistical variation of more than 10% over time. Here, there was no statistical evidence presented at trial, and in the brief, there were some cases that were appealed where there was all-white jury panels. The problem with that is, in Ringo v. State, they said that just listing a couple of cases is not a sufficient prima facie showing. So even if this error was preserved, they did not even make the prima facie showing that there was a underrepresentation, and so the claim should be denied.
As it relates to whether or not the error was prejudicial and your burden to prove, what inference can be drawn from the highlighting and the markings and the stars and the writing on these instructions that anyone other than the presumably it looks like the foreperson is the one who made the indications. I mean, at least they're all kind of similar. What inference is to be drawn that anyone other than the foreperson, how do you impute those markings to anybody other than the foreperson?
Well, I think that based on our general assumptions about the jury is that the jury considers everything together. They're instructed you're not supposed to consider things when you're, you know, at lunch or on breaks or if you're not sitting all together in the jury room. And given that presumption, I think if the foreman marked on the forms, then we can assume that the jury was considering those things. And
we don't have any clue whether that they voted on each star or asterisk or underlining that the 12 jurors said, we want that underlined. Just know one person may have underlined it or did underline it and did asterisk it, but it's nothing we could say the entire jury agreed to.
In this case, the jury was polled, right? In this case, was the jury polled as it relates to the aggravators and the hand? The aggravators are not only starred, they're written in hand and signed by the foreman. But
two things. One, I don't recall if the jury was polled or not. I'd have to check the record. But secondly, we do know that some of those handwritten notes were voted on because on the instruction, the aggravators that they found were circled and the person wrote true next to them.
Right. They wrote, and then those are the ones that were replicated
on
the verdict form. And you can tell that he was actually copying because he copied part of the language and then struck it out.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So I understand what you're saying about that. But what maybe I don't understand is these issues where he's underlined, where the presumably the foreman underlined it is not necessary, for example, as it related to the mitigation. How is there an inference from that as opposed to where presumably they voted because they marked true and then they rewrote it over here? I understand that, but these markings where he just underlines phrases in the mitigation part, where's the inference that anybody other than him or her, whoever the foreman was?
I think that comes from the presumption that the jury deliberates together and that the foreman is the only one who signs the verdict form, but we presume that that's the decision of the jury. I think that's just a presumption that we have to make in the
And the only person
jury
with
system.
The verdict form is the foreman, right?
Yes. But even if that were not the case, even if this court is not comfortable with that presumption, there are other factors that show that this was not prejudicial, namely the fact that in voir dire, the prosecutor said specifically, I have the burden to prove that death is warranted. He overstated his burden in voir dire, and that's something that didn't happen in Deck. We don't have the indications in Deck that the jury was confused about mitigation.
What were the closing arguments on mitigation?
The closing arguments on mitigation were mostly a plea for mercy and showing how he was and reiterating a lot of the facts presented by defense counsel here. They did not discuss the balancing of mitigation. That just wasn't a particular issue. Finally, I'd like to address the list of mitigating factors. She says that Cole and Tysius, those were all cases where the defendant was a stranger to the victim, and that somehow this prior conflict was a mitigating factor in the death, that this wasn't some premeditated, they obviously found that it was premeditated, but it wasn't some coolly thought out thing. That's not a mitigating factor. If we hold that as a mitigating factor, that eviscerates the purpose of things like restraining orders and trying to protect people from continued violence. Violence isn't less bad because it happens in the context of a family struggle. And here, this was coolly thought about. He said, as he killed the Deborah Wainwater, he said, "I told you I was going to do this." And he talks about it being about his baby and wanting to have time with his baby and be a father in the child's life. But the evidence showed that he shot the victim while she was holding the baby, and he left the baby there under the dead body, and the baby's mother's little sister had to come and pull the baby out. So this was not about the family struggle. This was him taking revenge for the slights that he saw in this struggle, and that's not a mitigating factor. The mitigating evidence in this case was no more powerful than it was in those other cases. Here, we have two mitigating factors. We have a serious crime. We have an instruction that has been held to correctly state the law. And so there was no prejudice from this instruction. Unless there are any further questions, the state would rest on its brief and request that you affirm the defendant's sentence. Thank you.
Ms. Wafer, on the veneer panel issue, how much did you have to show to make your prima facie case?
Actually, Judge, I'd have to go back and look at my brief and see what the requirements are, but I think, which I can do that quickly.
Well, while you're looking, did you raise the fair cross-section issue before the during the second trial, during the penalty phase retrial? Did you raise the fair cross-section?
Yes.
The opposing counsel said you raised other objections to the jury, but if I understood correctly, did not raise the fair cross-section issue again.
No, the fair cross-section was raised, and here's what happened. I'm going to read from the brief, which is from the record. So before the jury was sworn, defense moved to quash the panel due to the fact there are no African Americans.
Before the first trial?
This was before the second trial. This was before this current trial.
Okay.
Yeah. The jury chosen would not be a jury of his peers or afford him due process. And I believe cited, although I don't have it in the brief, the 14th and 6th Amendments in support of that motion. And now I've just actually lost my place again as far as what the prima facie requirement is. Judge, I apologize. While I'm looking for that, I'm going to try to do two things at once and talk about just a little bit mitigation, which although opposing counsel says, well, you can't consider certain things as mitigation, that's absolutely not true. The law is that mitigation is any reason that a juror has for imposing a sentence less than death, and there are no restrictions on it. That's the law. That's the law that comes from the U.S. Supreme Court and this court.
But do we look at how strong the mitigation evidence was in deciding if something was prejudicial?
I think you look at the potential for the instruction misleading or confusing the jury, mm-hmm. and where this instruction left out all reference to mitigation, which kind of gets to Judge.
Well, let me ask you about that, because instruction number 8, the things that were specifically listed for mitigation, and this instruction was given, was whether or not the defendant had a significant history of prior criminal activity, which it's pretty well stipulated this person had no criminal history, whether the murder was committed while the defendant was under the influence of extreme mental or emotional disturbance, and then the age of the defendant at the time of the offense. Well, those things are pretty well things that were not contested in this trial, aren't they?
And I think those are important things, and I think that in terms of omitting from what opposing counsel refers to as just a direction for filling out forms, it was prejudicial, and I disagree that, you know, the underlines, I agree with your question. I'm not sure of your position behind the question, but in terms of markings on the instructions, you know, I was in my mind trying to imagine what goes on in the jury room, and I can see the foreperson sitting there saying, okay, this is what we have to look at, and he does a little star. You know, it doesn't mean the jurors have all agreed on that. This is what we have to focus on because they list three things. And then down here at the final paragraph of Instruction 8, it reads, it is not necessary that all jurors agree upon particular facts and circumstances in mitigation of punishment. And he's underlined, it is not necessary. Now, I don't think I realized until today the ambiguity in that sentence.
But it is necessary if they're going to get death. If it's going to be a death, all 12 jurors have to agree.
Right.
If one juror who didn't see it, didn't underline anything on the verdict director, did nothing and just voted and said, I buy into a mitigation circumstance, that's it.
Then it's not death.
It's not unanimous.
Exactly. I think the problem with this sentence is that a jury could read that as saying, it is not necessary that all jurors agree upon particular facts and circumstances in mitigation. And then it goes on to say, if each juror determines. This instruction doesn't talk about, well, then what happens if all jurors don't agree? It just says it's not necessary, and a jury could read this as meaning, oh, well, we didn't all agree. We just, okay, so let's drop this. We didn't all agree.
You don't have to prove prejudice.
Well,
they have to prove non-prejudice. Well,
it specifically says that, basically what it does is it specifically allows all the jurors to consider mitigation with different levels of proof. In other words, one juror could assume they're under mental disturbance, and he gets to count that for mitigation for himself.
Right.
So it's pretty clear that if for yourself in mitigation you think that the person should get life, I mean, the instruction is pretty clear there that you get to
vote
for
life. Right. You can go with that. What it doesn't tell the jury is what happens if they don't all agree that, you know, if not, it doesn't cover the circumstance where not every juror finds something mitigating.
But this prior version of this MAI was found to be acceptable by our court in previous cases, you know, before the 2004 amendment.
And obviously the court thought this was much better.
So is it your belief that if the current version of an instruction is not used, it's per se error?
It is, yes, and the MAI tells us that. It is per se error. And
even
and
if other instructions might have covered it.
But the prejudicial effect is
prejudicial
error,
effect is to be determined by the court, right?
Are you saying it's per se prejudicial to leave this out?
There are cases that have said, older cases have said, it's, you know, if you don't follow MAI, it's per se prejudicial. I think the law is a little unclear on that. I think there are more recent cases that say.
You're talking about, I mean, we used to have the sandbag rule, basically, but that's been gone since the 80s, I think.
Right.
There's no balancing with looking at other instructions to see if that subject matter is contained elsewhere?
I think in determining prejudicial effect, the court can do that, but I think what you have here is, you know, where the final instruction leaves out altogether, not even a cross-reference to mitigation. You can't show there couldn't possibly be prejudice beyond a reasonable doubt. The state can't meet that burden. Thank you. For these reasons, I would ask you to reverse and remand for a new sentencing proceeding. Thank you.
Case is taken under submission and court is adjourned.